Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. Now, welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now, here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
I'm Matthew Christensen, associate producer at WPVC.
And I'm Bob McAdams, special events coordinator at WPVC.
Today we are co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our interviews with candidates for Charlottesville City Council seeking the Democratic nomination in the June 11th primary. WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. We provide this information to help you, our listeners, choose the best candidate.
With us in the studio this morning is City Council candidate Bob Fenwick. Bob, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Matt.
Bob, let's get started by getting to know a little bit about you. Where were you born, and what was your life like as you were growing up?
Well, I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. That's where my extended family comes from. My grandparents on both sides came over. We were Irish. Well, we still are Irish. They came over from Ireland on the boat through Ellis Island. And they wanted to settle on the East Coast, but they ran into a bit of difficulty because of people didn't want to hire Irish people. And they would tell us when we were young about the signs that said Irish need not apply. So they went to the middle of the country and settled in St. Louis, Missouri, and they've done quite well. They're citizens of note in St. Louis. My father served in the Pacific in World War II on General MacArthur's staff. And we came back after the war on the way to D.C. or Battle Creek, somewhere like that, and stopped in St. Louis. So I was maybe 5 or 6, and I remember my mother's side of the family. They had 6 boys. 5 of the boys, at that time, they were probably like 19 to 24, 25. And I was just a kid, and I saw these 5 boys who were just full of energy and out of the danger zone, basically, just wrestling and playing football, and I thought they were gods. I will never forget these young, strapping, fit men, and so I sort of wanted to be like them. So my father took a job with the Civil Affairs Department and went through Battle Creek, came back down to D.C., spent a lot of time in Alexandria, Virginia, near Arlandria, and that's when I started school, went to a Catholic high school in D.C., Gonzaga, and went to Georgetown University, and that's where I got a B.S. in physics. Later on, when I was in the Army paid for me to go back and finish my college degree. I took courses at G.W. University School of Engineering in civil engineering and construction management, so that's in my background, which I'll get into in just a little bit.
Okay. You're talking about your education, and you're beginning to talk about your work background. And I'm wondering how that has helped prepare you to return to City Council.
Well, at my age, I've done a lot of things, a lot of different things. Right now, I'm a Class A contractor, construction contractor in the state of Virginia. I was in the Corps of Engineers for about 7 years, and that's where I picked up a lot of my engineering knowledge, which really translates to the city today, specifically with Belmont Bridge, with infrastructure maintenance, those kinds of things that I have a background in. I can build a bridge. I can manage the construction of a bridge. So when those items come in front of City Council, I'll be well-versed and well-prepared to hopefully add just more than a yes or no on the vote. I think I could. There's a few things I could let people know. So I've done other things besides. I've written children's Christmas stories. I've written adventure novels based on my quote-unquote adventures in Vietnam. And I've got probably 6 or 7 websites, one of which is SevilleCitizen.com. And that's like an internet magazine or an internet newspaper where I put stories on what happens in Charlottesville, why it happens, the community discussions we have, not just around difficult problems like race, but around budgets, construction, the importance of not kicking maintenance dollars down the road to take care of it when it comes up. Specifically in that, we had 7 structurally deficient bridges in Charlottesville. One of them was Beta Bridge over by the university. That's been fixed. And we have 6 at the moment that need major repair, basically. Now, 6 years ago, The city estimated that it would cost $5-6 million to repair, to bring all six of those remaining bridges up to snuff. Now, just one bridge, the Belmont Bridge, is going to cost the city about $26 million. So that's the cost that the city will bear, $20 million lost, because they did not take care of infrastructure maintenance. That's money that could be spent for pre-K education, for affordable housing, work programs, community centers being open. We could find much better ways to spend that money than to just kind of throw it away. So that's one of the main things that I did when I was on council before, was to keep bringing that up and having the community discussion, and I will continue to do that.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Matthew Christensen, and with us in the studio today is Bob Fenwick. Bob, how have you been active in recent years to help improve Charlottesville?
Well, like many people, you just live your life in Charlottesville, and you see a number of things that you can contribute to. This is a community full of volunteers. I'm sitting right close to a couple of them right here in the studio. It's one of these things where if people see a situation where they can contribute and help, then they just jump right in. I did that on a number of things. This is April that we're doing this, and for a while I had a program called Charlottesville Sparkles, in which I would recruit young people from the university, from the community, and we'd make an effort to do a spring cleaning in Charlottesville. Got a lot of publicity about it. Everybody had fun. And it's one of these things, when we invite people from out of town into our community, I think we ought to show them a clean, smooth-running city. I go to City Market a lot, and I would see young kids from close by coming across and through the market. And I was figuring, well, these kids, they're probably from 5 to maybe 11 or 12. Why not get them to help the elderly people who frequent the market carry their purchases to their car or to their, if they live close, to their house? And I called it the Rickshaw Program. It was supposed to be like a name, Rickshaw. But everybody knows what a rickshaw is. It's like a taxi service. So we had fun with the name. The kids loved it. I'd love to do something like that again. But that's just an indication of, you don't have to go far in our community to see something that you can contribute to. Talent, your money, your ideas, whatever. And that's basically what I've tried to do.
Bob, you've been on city council before, and you know that running for city council is a huge undertaking, and it takes a lot of sacrifice. So why did you decide now to run?
Well, everybody knows, everybody can see for themselves the dysfunction of city council. And I saw it just like everybody else. My boys are out of the house. Thought I had things that I could still contribute. But it is a leap of faith, because it's tough. This really is on the books as a part-time job. But if you do it properly, it's easily full-time, 40 hours. I mean, easily. So when I finished my first term, it was a leap of faith to figure I could both resuscitate my business, a construction company, come jump back into this. But I feel strongly that there's things we have to do better with city council. People will ask me, and they'll say, you know, Fenwick, what are you doing? And I'd say, well, here's the deal. We all know, we can see the dysfunction. It's not pleasant. It bothers us. So somebody's got to do something about it. And it's either going to be you or me. And nobody ever took me up on a challenge for that. So I'm ready to go. It is tough, but I think it's something I can do.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Bob Fenwick. Bob, you know this very well. The events of 2017, including the debate, the votes on the statues, the July 8th KKK rally, and the Unite the Right rallies on August 11th and 12th, well, they traumatized our community. They also uncovered covert racism embedded in our institutions. More than a year and a half has gone by. Where do you think we are now in race relations in Charlottesville, and where are we headed?
Well, I think we're at an inflection point. I think we're at a point where many people, for the first time, realize that the African-American community was correct when they were saying there's a lot of racism in the city. It's not something people want to hear. It makes them nervous, gets them upset. That was a situation before the alt-right ever came into town. I remember I worked on four budgets for the city when I was on council. I voted no on three of them, because the procedure was to cut the funding for people who really had no voice before council. They would cut Ready Kids, legal aid, mentoring and diversion programs, and then the politicians would say, look, we're cutting were saving a lot of money. To my way of thinking, they were saving it in the wrong place. And we heard that loud and clear before the alt-right or the KKK or any other group like that came into town. And people were very upset about it. Sort of on a separate track, we have a lot of young people in town who are very wired into social justice and things like that. And they were getting upset. So it was like a lot of fuel for discontent was there. And they were just waiting, and it was ripe just to be lit, basically. That's what happened on May, I believe it was, you might have to help me, July 8th, yep. When that was the KKK. May 13th was when we opened the newspaper on a Sunday morning and saw men dressed in white with tiki torches at night chanting, "Russia is our friend," white supremacy slogans, Nazi slogans, KKK slogans, and it really stunned the entire city. Shortly after that, the KKK decided to come through the city, and that really fired people up more. And then, of course, we had August 11th and August 12th. So it's a situation where the city, the young people particularly, but they were, you know, of all ages, really, decided to confront what was coming into our city. We were invaded by armed men who were better armed with their weaponry, was better than the city police and the state police. There's no question about that. And they were accompanied by thugs who came from across the country. We had people from, I believe it was 37 states, from as far away as Alaska and California, Texas, Florida. All of them came here. And it wasn't, the monument, of course, was sort of their rallying call. But they weren't concerned about that monument. It was like an insurgency. I remember I was there right outside of what used to be Lee Park and Emancipation Park, and I think it's now Market Street Park or something. But it's the same park, same place. I was there on the morning of August 12th, and I saw these people march up and down the street, fully armed, with automatic weapons, some of them with bump stocks. And that's what makes an AR-15 or a SKS fully automatic, is a bump stock. And they would antagonize the citizens who came out to counter-protest. These guys had their fingers on the trigger, or fingers like an inch from the trigger, and they had a round in the chamber. And that's, I remember distinctly thinking, this is an insurrection. This is against the basic founding documents of our country, where all men and women are created equal, where we strive for domestic tranquility, and where we have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And those sometimes sound corny as slogans, but we all deeply believe that. And here were these people who thought they had a right to come into our city and spread hate and discontent to the point where they said, we're going to make people afraid to come out of their homes. So when I talk to people about this, sometimes I say it's sort of equivalent to a home invasion. And I didn't want to hear anything about a moral equivalency, that people came in to protest, peaceful protest that you can do under our Constitution, under those circumstances where what they preached was pure hate and insurrection and treasonous activities, and say the young lefties who stood up against them, who were unarmed, there was some kind of moral equivalence. I just don't buy that at all. And I to this day still have conversations trying to convince people that's going down the wrong road.
We can tell that this was a traumatic event, but if we fast forward, there, one of the major issues that people are bringing up in Charlottesville today is calling for more affordable housing, and it brings up related concerns about racial biases in zoning and gentrification. Now, which efforts by the city to increase affordable housing do you see as working and which aren't? What further action do you think the city should take?
Well, for this and for many other programs or solutions to problems, we have to make sure that we're not just speaking truth to power, but we're speaking truth to each other. And I'm still trying to work my way through how this conversation has settled on affordable housing, when what people really mean is subsidized housing. Now, I don't have any problem as part of the budget situation to have subsidized housing on the table. Everybody gets something from the government. Everybody pays something to the government. And it's like a negotiation when you have the money in a budget and you're trying to spread it across the city. Developers have subsidies. That's what basically what a special use permit is. The city is subsidizing more density, less parking, all of which, both of which, and many other things, are by law, are prescribed by law. So if they're getting subsidies, I see no problem with having subsidized housing as a subsidy. But my point is to construct a response to a situation like affordable housing and the lack thereof is not really going to do much. It hasn't in our city for as long as I've been here. 30, 35 years ago, when my wife and I moved down here, we couldn't afford to live in the city. I had to build a Lowe's house in Earliesville. We finally did rent a room on Bruce Avenue for about a year, I think, until I found an old house that had been abandoned where we live today. So affordable housing has always been difficult. Subsidized housing is even more difficult because people want to use that as a hammer in a political discussion. I hear things like, well, I can't afford my house. I find it hard to find housing, but I'm not getting anything from the government for free. And there's some truth to that. And that's because most of the housing, probably virtually all of the housing in Charlottesville today is for the upper income, unless you have federal tax breaks or something like that. So I would like somebody to tell me why they don't want to speak truth to each other and at least mention subsidized housing, because it seems to me we're promising people something that we're not going to be able to deliver on. This city has never delivered on it, and that's why I talked about 30 years ago my personal situation. And it's time to quit promising things and not delivering. That gets us nowhere.
Higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable in Charlottesville. The Orange Dot report showed the stark differences in income from one area of the city to another, often in parallel to racial divides. And how do you see the problem of economic inequality, and what should the city do about it?
The city is doing something about that. We're trying to get everybody up to minimum wage, which would bring people up. I think the federal minimum wage is still under $8 an hour, and that's pathetic. So we're bringing them up around 15, and when we bring up the minimum wage, everybody else's wage, say on city staff, goes up as well. So we're doing something about it. I was glad to see the University of Virginia finally adopt a minimum wage policy. That's going to help. But what happened, that comes with a caveat. They had already negotiated long-term contracts with Aramark, who hire the restaurant people and the janitorial people. And now they claim they can't break those contracts. Well, that's baloney. You know, you can do right by people at any time. And so I'd like to see them go a step further. But, you know, when somebody is on the wrong end of an issue and they're starting to turn around and do what's right, I don't really want to come down on them too hard. So they're heading in the right direction. I like to see that. In my business, in construction, I have never paid anybody minimum wage, because I don't want them leaving. If they're good people, I want them to stay with me and work. So, once again, it's a situation where the answer seems simple. Just give people more money. But you have to really think it through and make sure you're not damaging business. At this time, we would not damage business. Every time I read a story in the paper or hear a news thing come across radio or TV, it's Charlottesville is a wealthy city. We do very well. Well, some people do, and there's a lot of people that don't. And we can do a whole lot better than that. So I would be very careful about constructing yet another program, which really is not a long-term solution. And meanwhile, as a guiding principle, just be fair and honest And put yourself in people's situation where if somebody is, say, a senior citizen has to take a job to supplement Social Security, that they're doing it in a way that their pay is decent, that they might have benefits, because then you have a better worker. The stores that we all frequent around town, and if you see people that have been there for years, you know that the management or the owner of that business is treating his people right. That's always a standard to go by.
There's a New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between the races in Charlottesville city schools, and it alarmed educators, students, parents, and residents alike. Dr. Atkins, the school board, and others in the school division have tried to address the problem. What can you bring to city council to help solve it?
Well, first of all, as a basis for this particular discussion, we have to remember that we have a school board that's elected, and we can't dictate to the school board what they do. But here's what I'd like to see the school board do. We have been given, well, let me back up just a second. I have spoken strongly against bringing in out-of-town consultants, which really do us no good and take a lot of money out of our community. I think the schools, the school board, the school administration needs help to sort of chart a path. Now, we have people in town that can help do that. We have any number of former principals, school administrators. The talent is here, and they're willing to jump in and help. But we have been given basically an expert study in this New York Times article, and if my memory serves me, I think it was October 16th of last year. But anybody can Google that. It was in the newspapers, and it featured several young women from our high schools. In that situation, I would say take that study, pull from it everything that we could do, and then I will find a way to advocate for first working our way through the solutions that story, it was a New York Times, it wasn't, you know, some lesser publication, work through the solutions that they offer, because they go back to when we had Scotty Griffin here. So I was a little concerned that after this story came out, many people were very defensive, saying we hadn't been doing a good enough job. Well, we hadn't. I mean, the scores on standardized tests prove that.
Thank you, Bob. This is a great discussion, but we need to take a short break. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Matthew Christensen, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with City Council candidate Bob Fenwick. Bob, and Bob, we were talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier. Having healthcare available when you need it is a necessity for all the people in our area. And lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the city. What role do you see the city taking to address the real concerns of people who need to receive healthcare, and they need it when the health problem is there?
Well, Bob, before I answer that, let me circle back just for a second and finish up the education thing. Right when we were talking about the New York Times article, which is like a gimme, a free consultant report, the school administration talked about a $55 million capital improvement program. And I was a little bit disturbed by that. We should be talking about youngsters before we talk about $55 million in new buildings. I would like to see the city's concern turn to people now instead of buildings. All right, well, thanks for letting me circle back. Healthcare. Somebody's got to be breaking the law. To have Virginia, the highest health insurance cost in the country, something is not right. And you'll, in a political context, you'll hear people talk about capitalism and how it's good because it's competition and free market. Well, there's nothing like that in insurance, and there's something fundamentally wrong. Somebody's either breaking the law, or there's too much money in this situation, or something. A medium-sized state like Virginia should never be in that situation. To have one insurance company, And I know we're starting to get a second, but it's way beyond time for that. So it's the cost of health and health care and the cost of drugs and the cost of insurance that really is making a huge mess. And it's not only personally, it's for like social agencies, like legal aid or any number of social agencies that help people who have very limited resources. They have to really bump up, if they offer insurance coverage, then that's an economic hit that many of them really can't take.
Getting health care is tough, but getting care for mental illness is even more of a challenge. There are limits to insurance coverage, and there's a definite lack of professionals in the field, and that means that many people with mental health problems go untreated. What should the city do to help people with mental illness receive care?
Well, first of all, we can better fund the situations in town like Region 10 or human resources on city staff to really deliver service to the people who need it in mental illness. And there's a statistic which somebody might bring up about how many people in jail or in a prison are suffering from mental illness or substance abuse. That's something that we can do as a city. And that goes back to what I sort of opened the show with about how people with limited means available to petition their local government, city council, are really bearing the cost when their access to legal assistance, as an example, is sort of shared over, instead of 10 customers, you might have 50, where an elderly person might be threatened with eviction, or somebody that has a catastrophic medical situation and can't pay their bills. It just, everything just snowballs. So we can do something about that. And it's, once again, you think about the people first, and then you think about the buildings. When people come into town, it's rare that somebody will think about moving to Charlottesville or to relocate a business. And what they say is, you know, it's a town where we really like the buildings. Usually they'll say the schools are great. The neighborhoods are terrific. We saw kids playing in the street, riding their bikes in the street. It's usually more about the people, the friendliness of the town. And that's an area that we really have to get to work on.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Matthew Christensen, and with us in the studio today is Bob Fenwick. Bob, as you've alluded to, mental illness does lead many people, unfortunately, into our criminal justice system. The superintendent of the regional jail has said that 50%, that's half of the people in jail, suffer from some form of mental illness, and 80% have a substance abuse problem. What changes in our criminal justice system are needed, and what role can the city take to address these needs?
Well, let me first start by saying the departments that work in this area, and one of the candidates for this council election is a former social worker. At one time, she had 220 clients, and she was supposed to follow them and show them where to go for help and give them what help she could. Now, how in the world is one person going to handle a portfolio of 220, in many cases, desperately needing people? That's just impossible. And that kind of shows you where the city is valuing the people who need the help the most. I think we can do a whole lot better than that. I was on the there's a couple committees or boards that have business to do with the jails and the prisons. I was on one of them, and they had just started working on a program where when people were faced with incarceration, they would try to rate them in a way, and separate the hardened criminals, the people who wanted to hurt other people or to steal from other people. They tried to separate the men and women who were in that category from the people who had substance abuse or mental illness. Now, one of the last things I did when I was on council was to allocate $50,000 for what is now called the mental health court. And they just had their first graduates. And I would really keep an eye on that, because that's where we should be putting our effort. It's a whole lot easier to to take care of people when they're younger than to try to repair a broken man. And it's sort of in that vein.
Statistics reveal another issue with criminal justice. Systemic racism, from police stops to prosecutions to incarceration, whites have clear advantages over people of color. What can the city do to make sure all members of our community can trust that justice is equally administered by our police officers, prosecuting attorneys, judges, and prison staff?
Well, yeah, that's one of the contributing factors with the damage that the city suffered on August 11th and August 12th. The legal community was not set up well to differentiate between freedom of speech and public safety, for one thing. And they were not set up well to differentiate between what was overt racist advocacy, and that's the torches at night by men dressed in white. There's a law against that. We should have charged people for that. But what I heard was the judges were not going to allow this kind of charge to go forward. My response was, if it's a law and it's hurting people and hurting the city, charge them. Let the judge make that decision. If it's a bad decision, we might be able to appeal it, but at least it puts pressure on the legal system. I tried very hard to convince people, not just the city staff legal people, but the federal court and the local courts and the University of Virginia Law School, that what we were facing on August 12th was not freedom of speech, but it was public safety. And that was very unfortunate. We didn't have much help from the legal community at all. And what happened was, at the end, it was a traumatic experience. People were actually suffering from what I thought was PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And many people felt we had no help from people who should have been helping in the situation. We ran two black men out of town because many people blamed Maurice Jones and Al Thomas for what happened. That, to me, was very unfortunate. It sort of echoed what has happened in our past with Scottie Griffin and with the controversy we had about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and the DNA. This is just an ongoing situation we have to acknowledge, and we can do a whole lot better.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville City Council candidate forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Now, Bob Fenwick is in the studio with us today, and Bob, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood. Young people are condemning the lack of action by older people who are the ones in positions of power. How should Charlottesville respond to the worsening global warming crisis?
Well, for one thing, we ought to stop treating our young people as naughty children that we have to put in a corner and make them keep quiet. They're raising issues that are very important. Many of the older people don't like young people telling them they're wrong. And I think that would probably be one of the most important things. These young people are raising families. They're paying taxes. They have jobs. Many of them have their own businesses. And we just have to have a more honest community discussion about issues like environmentalism. To me, that's a no-brainer. What we have done in our country in many ways is we put ourselves above everybody else. We farm out the construction or the manufacture of batteries, any number of things, to countries who are desperate for capital investment. And then we kind of wash our hands and we say, well, you know, why aren't other countries being as good as we are in environmentalism? And it's because they don't have any choice. Many times the economic situation in these countries is so bad they are under a dictatorship. So there's many things, but I think really it starts with a more honest community discussion without treating these young people as somehow being contrary to the freedoms that we all deeply believe in, because, you know, we can learn a lot from them.
Now, a lot of problems interrelate, and one of the questions that comes up when you start dealing with a climate crisis is how to manage the climate crisis and at the same time strengthen infrastructure to handle a growing population. What should the city do in that regard?
Well, The mantra now is density. We have 12 square miles. We are surrounded by Albemarle County. We cannot pick up any additional land. And yet the mantra is density, density, density. I've heard that quote unquote a number of times. What that does is put a tremendous strain on the way we live in our city. It puts a strain on the roads and the bridges and the competence with which the city government can react to citizen needs. That's probably, we have to find a way, and that also bears on affordable housing. So with all the talent we have in our community, retired people, people at UVA, PVCC, people who move with their businesses down here, you know, we ought to be pulling them in and finding out what we can do, first of all, without adding an outside consultant, and second of all, make it meaningful when we have a citizen who volunteers his or her expertise in solving a problem. Many times people who are elected to council, or I guess any elected office, suddenly think they know all the answers, and they start acting like royalty. And then we get programs imposed on us that we have no idea why.
One aspect that's been suggested is we need to change our patterns of transportation to reduce carbon emissions, but the transportation system must be highly effective in order to be accepted by the public. What do you propose that the city do to meet these demanding needs?
Well, to me, that's sort of a no-brainer. And today it's raining. I could go down any road that has a bus stop, and I could almost guarantee you there is no shelter at the bus stop. When there's no shelter at the bus stop and it's raining or snowing or like 0 degrees out, there are no bus riders. So people lose confidence that they can use public transportation for their needs to go to the supermarket, for one thing, and to go to work and come back to work. The first thing I'd do, and I tried to do this, was to double the number of shelters at bus stops. I'm certain that that would boost the ridership on the buses. I remember maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I was fussing about empty buses. So lately I've been checking again, and they're just about as empty today as they were before. People really don't have confidence in the public transportation system. They try to make up for it with Uber, and there's an effort to try to make them use scooters, but that whether that will ever go anywhere is problematic. We have the buses, we have the shelters, we have the people to install the shelters, and we really ought to get about the business of putting them up.
Future trends point to more people living in urban areas with a high-density population, as you alluded to earlier. This means more living units within the fixed area of the city. Studies and practical experience show that humans also need green space for their well-being and to help promote community mental health. How can the city balance these needs together?
Well, the city has got to find a way to do that, because many times if somebody really gets flustered, you'll hear them say, you know, I've got to get away from everything. I've got to have time to think. We had that with McIntyre Park. In a way, we still have that. But when it comes time to make a decision between density and public welfare, it seems we're always at this point choosing density, and that is just not healthy. And we can do better. We can go into partnerships with the county and do things like Biscuit Run. That's going to be developed into a park. Be a partner in that. That's right on the periphery of the city. We are making efforts on a trail system with bikes. So this is just something we have to keep on the front burner.
Thank you, Bob. We need to interrupt this discussion to take another short break. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, Election Special Interview with Bob Fenwick. I'm Matthew Christensen, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with Charlottesville City Council candidate Bob Fenwick. Bob and Bob, we have one more segment to talk about the issues.
Yes, and Bob Fenwick, 2017 was a year of turmoil. People showed their distrust, their anger, their frustration with city council in long, emotional meetings. And I think you were there, right up there at the front. What do you see can be done to restore trust, confidence, and good order to the relations between city council and the public?
Well, this is going to sound simplistic, but treat people honestly, with respect, and equally. We were not doing that prior to the summer, in the late spring and early summer of 2017. And that's what contributed to our response to the invasion by the alt-right. And I've already mentioned, well, let me put it this way. If you say you believe in something like diversity or equality or public participation, then the elected officials should put their money, our money, where their mouth is. When you don't really believe in these things and you're just mouthing them for political purposes, either because your ambition is driving you to a higher office or you want to get a job at UVA, whatever the motivation is, this is not a city full of dummies. People know this. And I remember one lady who was a very strong advocate for her community stood in front of us and said, "Do you think we're stupid?" And it's just struck me because I have been thinking the same thing, not in those words, but I think she encapsulated it better than I did. People know when they're not getting a fair shake, when there are people in our community who have more access to money or, say, economic help. They know this, and it just makes their life that much harder. So it's simplistic, but that's the answer, is to put into practice what we say we all believe: honesty, fair treatment, and diversity.
Now, at times, members of city council just don't seem to get along very well, which makes working effectively, as well as relations with the public, even harder. If you're elected to serve on the city council again, what will you do to improve the working relations among city councilors themselves?
Well, I'll start by saying when I was on council, there were two attempts to formally censure me. When they came up, it caught me by surprise because my job, I thought, and I still do, it was to represent. And if I represented a position in public that was contrary to the other councilors, I figured I was doing them a favor because obviously they hadn't gotten the word. Specifically, it was about paid parking around the downtown mall. Nobody asked for that. No, the businesses down there were against it 90% easily, and yet that was imposed on us. And I was very strong in my opposition, and that prompted one of the censure attempts. Now, when that happened, I told them, if this happens again, I said I was going to walk out of the room. If it happens again, I'm going to walk out of the room and call a press conference, and I'm going to tell the press and the media exactly what's going on in here, because this is a kangaroo court. It's that kind of disrespect for the people that you're supposed to be colleagues. We call each other colleagues. My way of thinking, you just don't treat people that way. So I don't think that's going to happen in the new council. The old council was really fractured by ambition and political words that really didn't mean much. I don't think that's going to happen, and we'll just see. I'm always ready to compromise. It was very, very difficult to compromise when I was on there. I think that's going to be different.
The fundamental structure of city government, 5 part-time elected councilors plus an unelected full-time city manager and staff, what would challenge the ability of any group of people to work together effectively? What do you imagine the city government could do to work better, to accomplish more? And what role does the state government have in local dysfunction?
All right, well, you might have to bring me back to the state government because there's something important I'd like to say about that. But, you know, we have this discussion periodically. We have a system of local government, of strong city manager, weak mayor. It's served us well. There's always friction. There's friction in any organization. There's friction in businesses. Anybody that goes to church regularly knows there's friction in churches. They have some of the worst fights that you can imagine. So these things happen, and you just work your way through them, and you try to behave civilly. And keep in mind, the goal is to make this, to put the city in a better place because of the discussions you're having. To my way of thinking, when these dysfunctional situations come up, it's almost never the problem of the process. It is always the problem of people. People, for one reason or another, refuse to get along, refuse to compromise, try to hurt each other, and that's what causes the problem. Now, in our system of government, we have a way to deal with that. Sometimes you have to wait 2 years or 4 years to turn over a council, but we're in that situation now, and so that's the message that I brought when this, do we change the government of the city? I say, no, just change the people. They're the ones that are making the decisions that put us where we are. Now, real quick, the state government. The city of Charlottesville was betrayed by the state police on August 12th. We had gotten almost no help from the state police. They showed up at our planning meetings. They engaged with us in our planning meetings. The governor said he authorized 1,000 state police people, not just troopers, but admin people, to come into our city. I don't think it was that many, but that's what he said. The morning of August 12th, when the state police got here late, after the alt-right had already started marching into our town, they said they were off the plan. We didn't know it, but they had been working on a separate plan for August 12th all along and never told us about it. It was their job, the state police, to go out into the crowd, sometimes a mob, and to separate people, arrest them if necessary, but at least separate them from fighting. We learned 8 o'clock that morning that they were not going to do that. They were supposed to stand in front of the barriers. They said, we're not going to put people in that mess. And they stood behind the barriers. And this contributed to a lot of discontent by citizens. They said the police just stood there and did nothing. And there was an element of truth about that. They stood behind the barriers. They didn't come out in front. Rarely they did. And people thought they were not getting the help they should have. The city police, and they didn't distinguish between state and city police. They just said the police didn't help us. The job of the city police was to be like a mobile force. If you had a very, very serious incident, they were back hidden, and they would go to a certain position and be like a reinforcing force. So in that situation, the state, I call it a betrayal, and it just left the city in a much worse position. So we got to be careful what we accept from the state. They thought it was beneath them for the state police, which is a separate force that's under the governor's command. They didn't want to be taking orders from a small town police force. So we just have to, I don't think many people understood what happened there. And we just have to get our fair share also from the state.
In what areas do you think Charlottesville could best collaborate with our neighbors like Albemarle, UVA, and other neighboring counties?
Well, we have a beautiful situation just ripe for collaboration. That's the Rivanna River. I remember when that, a couple years ago, I was on the Rivanna River Commission, and I said we have to be very careful about development along the river until we have a community. In this case, it was I think Fluvanna and the communities to the east of us, Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville. Until we have a plan for how we want to develop, and that doesn't mean all buildings, it means trails and parks and this kind of thing, until we can get that under control, we should halt development along the river. So that's one area where the Rivanna River is a resource, not just for water, but for what we were talking about earlier about green space. And that is one of the main reasons, one of the main areas that we could collaborate.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Forum interview with Bob Fenwick. I'm Bob McAdams. Bob, you're running for city council. How do you describe your candidacy, your campaign to voters in a moment or two when you have standing there at their door or in an elevator?
Oh, an elevator speech. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, people probably know that candidates go to school to know how to run for office. There's a process that they say you have to follow. You have to identify your demographics, how many old people are going to vote for you, how many young, whether African-American or white people, religion. They just break them down into categories. And the book way to do it is to have three subjects ready to go. So if you get stuck in an elevator, you can give what's called an elevator speech in about 30 seconds. What I found out is, with five people on the council, you're going to have 15, maybe not that many, but you have up to 15 major programs people want to do, whether it's Ravana River, education of young children. There's any number of things. So you quickly get lost in your political promises. And I boil it down. The three things that I would like to do, and I've tried to do this the first time around, was representation, because I believe the strength and the beauty of our city rests in its citizens. When they come in front of council and give their opinions, we should take that to heart and not just dismiss them as people who don't know what they're talking about, because most times they know better what they're talking about than we do.
Now, the June 11th primary, it's coming up quickly, and to get elected, you have to win nomination to become one of the three Democratic candidates for city council. Then you also need to be one of the three winners in the November 5th general election. What is your plan, and what organization are you building to accomplish that?
All right, so Bob, what you're asking me to do is divulge my strategy? Is that what I...
Idea of what you're doing.
I know. Well, my strategy is to get out and talk to as many people as possible. this interview we're doing right now is part of that. People can get in touch with me after this, after they hear this, or they can flag me down on the street. I'm the one that's driving that white van that says homeworkwithbobfenwick.com. You won't miss me because I'm all over the place. Many politicians will promise, you know, they'll say, well, my door is always open. And what I say is, my door is going to be closed and the lights will be turned off, because I don't wait for people to come to me. I try to go out to the neighborhoods, to the neighborhood associations, to the churches, to the picnics, to the meetings, and talk to as many people as possible. And most often, what they're concerned about is what I'm concerned about as well. How the police treat people, whether the young children are being taken care of, whether single mothers are high on our list of priorities. There's any number of things. And everybody should have access to their elected officials, not because we know everything, but because we make the decision, and that's critical.
Every campaign needs to pay for the basics to get the candidate's message to as many people as possible. How will you raise the funds to pay for those basics for your campaign?
Well, when I'm going around campaigning, it's just a very open situation. You know, say, I usually have something to offer, like what we call a palm card, which is a small card, bio information or issue explanations, whatever it might be. Or I'll give them, I'll ask them if they want a yard sign. Now, because, well, let me, the first time around, I figured out what my hourly rate was serving as a city councilor. And it was about $8 an hour. That covered gas, maybe some lunches, things like that, secretarial supplies that I had to use. So we don't get paid much, and I'm not advocating that we get paid more, but it's hard to run a campaign and fund it properly. Radio and TV is a huge expense, but people, that's how they get their news a lot of times. I still run, the campaign's been going probably for a month, maybe 2 months, and I still run into people who said, are you running? Are you running? And it surprises me that people really don't know. But that's where the expense comes in. You have to have an office. In the past, I did not have an office. And it's just tough. You want it to be professional, but you don't want to lose your touch with the people.
What is the best way for people to get in touch with your campaign, to learn more about you, and to volunteer or donate?
Well, I mentioned my websites before. My official political website is votebob.net, no spaces. But I also have the other websites that I service. One is cvillecitizen.com. Or I put my thoughts down about August 12th on august12.space, S-P-A-C-E, august12.space. And when I do these, I always give an email. People can email me. But people are flagging me down every day, basically, whether I'm on a downtown mall or at Barracks Road or wherever. It's I try to make it as easy as possible that people get a hold of me.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Bob, thank you so much for spending this hour with our WPVC listeners. This is one in our series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking the nomination for city councilor, county supervisor, delegate, and state senator in the June 11th primary. Each of the interviews will be available on podcast from our website, 947wpvc.org, after they have been broadcast. We thank Bob Fenwick for giving of his time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice of nominees for city council. Next week, we will have Albemarle Board of Supervisors candidate Gerard Smith in our studio for our election special interview. Thanks for listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.